Chapter 13. Kip stood in the captain's cabin trying to put on his breaker face before he headed out to face the squad. They were going to be rightly livid with him. After all their training, the mighty had reached a rough equivalency with each other, a working strength. Adding Tisis to the mighty's war party would be like adding a fifth leg to a dog. They couldn't help but trip over her, have to compensate, slow down, and get tentative as they had to protect her. But here he was. He opened the door to a bright, shining noon, good wind and few clouds. He acted nonchalant, as a young groom would be after a wild night of connubial exertion, just a twinge of smugness as he walked astern toward where the mighty were working to create a skimmer. The captain, a black-haired, fair-skinned blood forester with long moustache and beard like a lamprey attached to his face, grinned at him as he walked past. "Finally found the pearl button, huh?" he asked, slapping Kip on the back and laughing. "The what?" But Kip just blushed ruefully, accepting the teasing as if he didn't think the man was an asshole. "Day 5," the captain said. "Ha! We had bets going. You won me 2 dinars. Seems like a smart lad," I said, "and that's one eager lass he's got there, if I don't miss my guess. Won't take him a whole week," I said. I was drunk. "You done me right, though, and you clearly did her right last night." "How many times was—" "Hey, hey," Kip said, putting a hand out to stop the man. "That's my wife, huh?" It had been 4 times. 4 times, lying side by side, throwing their bodies around to make the bunk squeak, and Tisis crying out, while Kip grunted and groaned. And then they tried to muffle the sounds of their laughter.
4 times, Kip had asked Tisis. "Isn't that a lot?" "Not really. I mean, sometimes, when I—"
In sub red, Kip could see the heat of her blush spread through her face, despite the darkness.
"When you—" he'd asked. "When I've heard people talk about lovemaking," she'd said.
Even though he'd had the impression that wasn't what she was talking about, he said,
"I always thought those were exaggerations, bragging, because then I'd hear the older blackguards joke about not being that young anymore." "But we are young," Tisis had said.
Young enough that neither of us knows how many climaxes in a night is believable, Kip had thought. So they'd faked 4 for her and 3 for him, and laughed and plotted until the early hours. He'd had as much fun in bed as you could have without having as much fun as you want to have. Apparently they'd hit the correct number to be believable for their age, though, because the captain raised his hands in quick surrender.
"I didn't mean no disrespect," he grinned.
"Quite the opposite. Good day, my young lord."
Pearl button? The mighty were deep in discussion at the stern where they were building the skimmer. All wore their blacks with the insignia of the mighty at the collar, a powerful figure with arms outspread, radiating power, but his head downcast as if in prayer or concentration or grief. No matter how many times Kip saw it, something about that figure stirred something deeper than memory in Kip. How had Andros Guile picked this emblem? Surely that scorpion had a soul insensitive to art.
"Breaker!"
Cruxer called out. The mighty's leader was tall and slender, confident and handsome, a blue by nature as well as by the thin Luxin streaks in his brown eyes. He was serious but not humorless. He always did the right thing, and he always did it quickly. It made him a great leader. Believing the best of others, he somehow brought it out.
"Breaker, would you get over here and tell Ben Haydad that he's not as smart as he thinks he is?"
Kip had expected some jibes about sleeping in. But, of course, that he dodged jibes for the moment didn't mean they wouldn't come later. But when the squad teased him, it didn't bother him. They'd given up everything to be here with him and with each other.
"What are you destroying now?" Kip asked, joining the circle between Muscle Mountain Big Leo and Ben Haydad, who'd had to hop around on a crutch with one knee bound in a splint since his injury during their escape from the light guards at the Chromeria.
Ben Haydad said, "I'm destroying suddenly obsolete methods of shipbuilding, and maybe sailing too. I'm destroying old strategies of naval combat."
Struggling to handle his crutch, he took off his yellow and blue hinged spectacles and alternated between gesturing with them and rubbing the lines they left above his ears from how tight he wore them.
"Breaker, he destroyed the skimmer," Big Leo said. "Literally."
"Wait, what?" Kip asked. "I thought it was—" He peered over the side into the water, where he'd expected to see the skimmer they'd been building for 5 days. There was nothing there.
"Look, look," Ben-Hadad said, half apologetic, half, "give me a chance to explain. It took me a few days to intuit the principles of hydrodynamics."
"Hind what?"
Farkoudi asked. Not quite an idiot, nor quite a savant. Farkoudi was the guy you could count on to snort fire pepper paste on a dare. He was the guy who'd be openly picking his nose for the next 6 weeks, happy to have the excuse. He was also the guy who'd throw his dopey bulk in the line of fire for you, without a second thought. With an affable roundness only accentuated by his shaven head, he was their best grappler, a blue and green drafter, and solid in every sense of the word. "The way the water moves, Firk," Kip said.
"Duh, it moves downhill. You smart guys sometimes,"
Farkoudi shook his head.
Ben-Hadad ignored him. "It's not an original design, it's just I didn't understand how."
"It's not a design at all," Big Leo said. "You destroyed our skimmer."
"I meant the next one, and that skimmer was garbage," Ben-Hadad said.
"You designed it. You said it was the best skimmer ever built, and I helped build it. Probably drafted 2 years off my life,"
Big Leo said, pointing to the red rising like floodwaters a quarter of the way up his dark irises.
"I worked my arse off on that thing."
"Still got a long way to go before you're arseless,"
Winston said quietly, giving a significant glance at Big Leo's haunches. Whereas Big Leo was by far the biggest of the elite athletes, Winston was by far the smallest. Slight and unremarkable, except for the bars of yellow luxin staining his cold blue eyes, he was the only member of the Mighty One might not be afraid of if one met him in a dark alley. And that would be precisely the wrong reaction. Not only was Winston the slipperiest killer of them all, Winston simply didn't care. With his longbow, he took shots that none of them could make. And he took shots that none of them would make because they'd be worried about the consequences of hitting civilians or friends. Winston seemed incapable of worrying about consequences.
"True, and I was right," Ben-Hadad said, soothing Big Leo. "But skimmers are a new invention. Gavin Gyle just discovered them. That's what makes them... Look, trust me, look. I'll do all the drafting myself."
"No, I forbid it," Cruxa said, speaking up.
He usually let them sort things out themselves, so when he intervened, they instantly shut up.
"We trust you, Ben-Hadad, but you're not drafting it alone. You can't burn yourself out. We share the burden of making the new one, but next time, you ask me before you destroy what belongs to the squad, understood?"
"It was my design."
"And the squad's work," Cruxa interrupted. "We all throw all of what we have into the pot. For some of us, that may be just muscle."
"That would be me,"
Farkoudi volunteered unnecessarily,
"on a particular project, but we all give our all, right?"
A brief moment passed, and Kip wanted to rush in and try to make things better. Cruxa and Ben-Hadad butted heads constantly. Cruxa saw everything in black and white, and Ben-Hadad saw relentless shades of grey possibility. For Ben-Hadad, his life and honour were the Mighty's, but his creations were his own. He valued himself for his brilliant inventions, and that one thing he didn't want to share, and he didn't see keeping that little bit as being too much to ask of a squad he gave everything else. For Cruxa, you were either in or out. But Kip didn't try to fix it. Later, maybe each would be more receptive to reason, more flexible. Not in front of everyone, though. Ben-Hadad was trying to keep his temper, saying tightly,
"I'll make the best skimmer I can, so the squad can be safe."
"Come, Captain, sir,"
the lookout cried out from above. At the alarm in his voice, the squad reacted immediately. Low stances, spectacles flipped on, team fanning out, looking for threats, hands to weapons. That most of the calamities that might come at them at sea would be impossible to oppose didn't matter. This was instinct. And the galley had no proper crow's nest, so the lookout merely stood atop the main yard, balancing himself with one hand on the rigging. Above the full-bellied sails, the man was pointing north.
"Four,"
Kip said. They turned and looked, but saw nothing.
"Go,"
Cruxa ordered. So they ran toward the prow, sliding or jumping down the steep stair ladder from the rear castle, dodging cursing sailors and dashing up onto the low forecastle as the captain bellowed at his sailors. The captain might be an ass, but he seemed a capable one. When they reached the prow, the Mighty spread out, each of them having drawn in his color except Kip, who was slower. Kip was still swapping spectacles in and out of his hip case, stealing glances at the dirty white sails to soak up each colour in turn.
"What is that?" Kruxer asked.
"Ben," Farcudi said.
"Uh-huh,"
Ben-Hadad said.
"We're looking north, right?"
"North-northwest, technically, but why is the sun rising in the north?"
Within moments, all of them saw it. At first it looked like the sun on the horizon, but blinding yellow, like the risen sun, not red as the sun on the horizon ought to. And as it rose, the orb deformed, elongated, like the longest finger of a great hand, then simply the first burgeoning cloud of a vast cloud bank rolling into view.
"Storm!"
the lookout bellowed. The sailors sprang into action, a storm they knew how to handle. Only the mighty were frozen. They knew this was no normal storm. This was a Luxin storm, ravager of cities, slayer of armies, or Hollum's wrath, the god's lash, and it was coming straight for them. As the luminous cloud bank filled the horizon, the sea reflected the sky with an unnatural clarity. Tiny bright needles flashed between sea and sky as if knitting them together with light. This was the consequence of the seven satrapies not having a prism to balance the colours. Drafters inevitably caused imbalances, and these storms broke out spontaneously. No one understood yet why they happened where they did, what exactly sparked them, or why they ended.
"Breaker! Winston!" Kruxer said. "How tight is that yellow?"
Winston licked his lips.
"Hard to tell from this distance, but, I think it's better than I can do."
Kip flipped on his yellow spectacles.
"It's all over the yellow spectrum. But some of it, yes, some of it's solid." "Is it raining? Anyone?"
Kruxer asked, though he had the best eyes of the mighty. They'd heard stories of a crystal storm in a little village in Attash. Blue Luxin crystals the size of fists and sharp as razors had fallen from the sky and shredded everything within a day's walk, but no farther. No one had known whether the tale was true. Solid yellow would be worse. An odd wind started blowing at their backs, blowing them toward the storm front. It was like no wind Kip had ever felt. It was utterly constant, no gusts, no variation in its strength at all, just a simple, constant, hard push. The distant seas in front of the storm fell flat in an expanding circle, no chop, no white caps, no variation at all. The sea became a perfect mirror for the bright clouds above. The great luminous clouds running straight against the wind seemed to crash into it as if it were a wall, and then the clouds flipped over that wall in a mass like pancake batter spreading on a griddle in concentric rings. But everywhere the clouds folded over, the bright needles flashed again. As they got closer, they were mere needles no more, but tree trunks, massive pillars from the sea to the heavens. At each point, the flat sea pulsed, throbbed yellow, gathering like a vortex, then cratering downward before exploding into the sky. Yellow Luxin shimmered into light, but each pillar was also wreathed in chasing fires, spiraling into the sky. Each pillar pulsed light for several heartbeats, then blew apart, falling into water and light, onto seas now crisscrossed with tremendous waves, expanding in rings from the Luxin lightning strikes.
"Or Hollum have mercy,"
someone said.
"This is impossible," Ben-Hadad said.
"It's happening,"
Farcudi pointed out helpfully.
"No, this is impossible," Ben-Hadad said.
"You smart guys," Farcudi said.
The wind died, and the sea abruptly went still and flat as the front edge of the light storm passed over them.
"What do we do?"
the captain bellowed at them. Kip tore his eyes away from the storm. Everything that could be secured on the ship had been. The sailors had reefed the sails, trying to give the ship enough propulsion to quarter the waves, but not so much resistance to the wind that the masts broke. Then Kip saw that everyone was looking at him, as if he had the answers.
"Turtle,"
Kruxer said. At first, Kip thought Kruxer was talking to him, the turtle bear, the ridiculous beast that he'd come up with as his own avatar and that had ended up somehow tattooed on his forearm, invisible except when he drafted. But the rest of the squad understood. They drew together around Kip, and the green and blue drafters among them began putting Luxin shields up around them to protect all of them from the scything rain. Going below would have been safer, but Kraxer thought Kip was going to figure this out. We're facing a force of nature, and they expect me to fix it? Or Holland's balls? Why is it impossible, Ben? Kip asked.
Because it's yellow.
He stopped, as if that were enough to explain the dread on his face.
And, Kraxer demanded, the storms come from imbalances. Yellow is the center of the spectrum. It's the fulcrum. It shouldn't be possible for the center to be out of balance, so if it is, we are truly...
But the rest of whatever he said was lost, as the sailors screamed out. The captain shouted,
Secure yourselves to...
A few hundred paces directly ahead, the sea was cratering. Lightning bolts raced low on the water toward the crater and were sucked in. With a concussion that shook the galley and knocked down most everyone standing on deck, the sea exploded upward. Fire spiraled around the pillar of light, discharging into bright clouds above. Discharging. Kip clambered to his feet. Water and yellow Luxin dropped on the ship in bucketsful, sweeping several sailors and half the mighty off their feet, but it was liquid yellow, thank Orholm. It flashed into light as it hit the deck, blinding but not killing anyone. Whether they would be lucky enough to be hit only by liquid yellow, or whether there were solid razors of yellow yet to come, Kip had no idea. Discharging, because it was out of balance. Kip left the turtle, rushing to the prow, just in time to feel it rise as the galley climbed a mountainous wave.
Breaker, get back! Kraxer shouted.
But the wave was too massive, too fast for the galley to climb. The prow dug into it instead, slowing the ship as suddenly as if it had hit a wall. Winston was thrown off his feet. Kip snatched his wrist as he tumbled and was drafting before he knew it. He manacled one of his own wrists to a line connecting the prow and mainmast and the other to Winston's wrist. Then water hit them like the slap of a sea demon's tail. Kip and Winston were blasted back and then up the line into the air, halfway up to the mainmast. Blinded and with lungs half full of water, they were dropped, zipping down the line back to the deck as the wave crest passed, and the prow suddenly dove, racing down the back side of the wave. The rest of the mighty were still crouched, clinging to the deck in a low, Luxin-imbued circle like a tick burrowed into the ship's skin. As soon as Kip's feet hit the deck, he was running. He threw Winston toward the squad, not even aware of releasing the solid yellow Luxin he'd drafted. Solid yellow? That fast? He leapt over the forecastle rail, out onto the beakhead as the ship bottomed out between the waves, and lashed himself down with yellow Luxin as the ship began its climb again. A deep breath, and the beakhead plunged into the next wave, the waters pouring over him, scouring at him as if he were an offensive stain. But then air. This second wave was smaller than the first had been. Kip popped to his feet, reaching for the lens holster on his left hip. If yellow was out of balance, that meant... If the center of the spectrum was out of balance, it could be out of balance only with the ends of the spectrum. Kip's lens holster had seven pairs of spectacles ending at subred and superviolet, which balanced each other. But there was one color beyond subred. Tears color, peril. In legend, there was another in the opposite direction, beyond superviolet, key. Kip had no idea how he'd draft key. Hell, all he knew about drafting peril was that Tia's eyes went so wide open the black of her pupils took over the entire eye. Lashing one hand onto the line that held the foreyard to the figurehead, Kip moved forward as far as he could. There was no third wave. A bit of luck, finally.
Breaker! Whatever you're going to do, do it fast!
Kraxer yelled. The sea had gone still again. An unnatural flatness that defied reason after the titanic waves that had just passed. Lightning passed low over the waves to sizzle against the galley's hull. For the first time Kip could recall, he saw fear in Crux's eyes as they both realized that the next pillar of fire and light was going to spring up directly beneath the galley. There was no way the ship or anyone in it would survive. Kip turned to the waves. He stared straight down and widened his eyes. Wider despite the pain, despite the brightness, into sub-red, and then beyond. It was like opening his mouth too wide, discomfort turned to pain, and the light stabbed daggers into his face. And wider still. He almost gagged, and then Parol snapped into focus as if it had been waiting for him. Parol was racing below the waves like clouds blowing through a storm-swept sky. And Kip's awareness was pulled along with the gale to its center, where it swirled beneath the galley. A hard knot of peril
And something else, Key, was forming, buzzing like the lightning catcher atop each of the Chromeria's seven towers. Kip could feel the charge building. Building! Oh, hells. The Parol and that other colour were just touching and slowly twisting together like partners coming together to dance. Kip could feel the pressures massing behind each, and they twisted together hard, spinning together, lightning crackling. Kip flung them apart with all his will. The seas exploded and his Parol-wide eyes were blinded. Everything was lost in the twin roaring to his left and right, and great jets of water streaming skyward pressed in on him. He could feel the jets twining together in the sky above the ship like wire and discharging the imbalanced yellow. The Parol and Key wanted to snap together, wanted to crush Kip in their embrace. Kip stood, hands extended, arms extended, shoulders knotted with effort, his screams lost in the cacophony. He wept in agony, tear water blending with seawater and bright water, salt to salt, deep to deep, magic to magic. Nothing but magic. Kip barely dared blink, though the world was a wash of undifferentiated light stabbing him. He couldn't lose the colours. His head lolled, chin down, arms out, shaking, exhausted, defiant. It didn't matter where he looked with his blind eyes. The magic was everywhere. Magic was all. And it was crushing him. It was like holding apart two rams who wanted to butt heads to show their dominance, each side lurching and twisting, ever lunging in. Kip's arms were stone. He dropped to his knees, still holding the Parol and Key streams apart. His arms sagged halfway to his sides, his will almost extinguished. He wanted to drop dead, drop into the sea and be no more. But before his arms fell, he felt a presence behind him, embracing him, propping his arms up. "I've got you, Kip. Come on, Kip. We're almost through." Kip? Everyone on the squad called him Breaker. Who? "Help me!" Tysis shouted, and Kip felt another pair of hands on him. "Breaker, you can do this," Cruxa said, pulling him to his feet. Kip was weeping. Oh, Orholam, it hurt. Stabs of pain shot through his eyes, down his spine. His arms were gelatinous, his will was dust. "Another 10 count, Breaker," Cruxa said. "Give me just another 10. Mumbling through his tears, Kip counted with Cruxa. "Captain, tell me when we're through," Cruxa shouted over his shoulder. 8. 9, and keep going, Breaker. I know you. You got 5 more. But Kip is gone.
You've got 5 more. I know you, Andros Gyle. Plans within plans, the young woman says.
Catalina's the kind of awkward girl whose beauty has unfurled with a crack, like a sail suddenly filling with wind. Luminous dark skin, rare blue eyes, and a shy smile. It's Andros's luck that he's the first suitor to come pluck this flower. It's a good bit of luck, too, because he would have had to woo her regardless of her beauty or lack thereof. She has what he needs. He waggles his eyebrows at her, and she laughs and puts another pile of scrolls on the desk. But she holds 2 back.
"But I can't possibly show you these 2. If anyone learned, I'd lose my position here and shame my family and the entire Tiru tribe. I'm the youngest under-librarian in Perea."
"If anyone learned, huh?"
Andros smiles recklessly.
"Oh, what could I possibly do to convince you of my discretion?"
She feigns a frown, and that feigned frown hits Kip like a slap in the face. He didn't recognize the smile. He didn't recognize those clear eyes. He didn't recognize the beauty. But he knows that frown. Kip gasped. He was weeping, blind, and hands were lifting him, carrying him.
"You did it, Kip, you did it! Or Holland's mercy, you saved us," she said.
It's not her speaking. No, it's Tysis. Tysis was the one who'd come to him, caught him, saved him. He was weeping, and he was ashamed of his weeping.
"What's wrong with his eyes? One is... and the other?"
"Cover his eyes! He's staring at the sun, you fools!"
the captain shouted, and people were shouting orders and suggestions back and forth. Kip heard a door bang open, and he was bustled inside. His knees hit what had to be his own bed, and he sat, gentle hands guiding him.
"We should strip him out of—"
a concerned woman said.
"Just let him breathe, Verity," Tysis said.
Kip looked up.
and despite that his eyes were closed and now bound with cloths, he could see three figures in the room. Three. Verity and Tisis moved about, trying to take care of him, their bodies luminous in a colour beyond purple, their clothes and hair translucent wisps, any bits of metal, buckles and jewellery and hairpins glowing bright white. He was seeing in key. The third figure was glassine, but in full, natural colour. She smiled, her lips full, her hair a great curly halo around her head. Rhea Saluz, the warrior, the librarian, the immortal, somehow more real than real. She smiled at him, glowing, literally glowing with pride for him. Kip had no idea how an emotion could have colour, but for some reason it seemed natural. The enemy steered that storm toward you, so this much healing is allowed me. You won't be blinded. Not today, she said. And she extended her hand as if making the sign of the three on him, her thumb to one eye, middle finger to the other, and her forefinger touching his forehead where the eye of the mind was. Warmth shot through him, and he fell into blessed sleep.